Neil, I'm going to ask you, first of all, if you can remember your grandparents.
I remember my grandmother more vividly than I do my grandfather. He died, I think I wasn't 2 years old yet.
Is this when your mother's side or your father?
My mother's side.
Okay.
My father's parents, I didn't know them at all.
Okay, all right. So we're talking about your mother's grandparents.
Yes, my
and
mother.
Do you know where they grew up?
My mother's mother, my grandmother grew up in St. Mary's, Georgia. And my grandfather grew up right here in Fernandina.
Okay.
In Old Town.
Would your grandparents be related to Estelle Griffin somehow? Is there a relationship there?
My grandmother, yes.
Okay.
I think my great-grandmother and Estelle's mother were sisters. I think that's okay. I'm not sure.
And I was talking to a lady named Elsie Green the other day, and do you know Elsie?
Yes, I do.
And she's got relatives in St. Mary's, too,
yes.
So
yeah.
It's all tied together here
yes.
somehow.
Yes.
Okay. How old were you when your grandparents passed away?
I was born in 1941. My grandfather died in 42. I think it was. He died.
Okay.
And my grandmother, she died in 72. So,
okay.
So she actually my grandmother was more instrumental in raising me because my mother got married and moved to Jacksonville.
Okay.
So
let's pursue the grandmother just a little bit. She died in the 70s and you were born in the 40s. And she had a lot to do with raising you.
Yes.
Did you ever hear your grandmother talk about such things as slavery or the Civil War? Now, she obviously wasn't alive, but she from what we're trying to do is through you and through things she told you, see how far back we can go.
Yes. I don't remember her ever talking about the Civil War.
Okay. No. How about slavery?
I can't say that I recall her talking
about
slavery.
None of her ancestors, well, obviously there were slaves, but
yes.
she really didn't communicate about it, okay.
Yes.
How about her family life? What can you tell me about your grandmother's family life that you learned as a youngster, and maybe she even told you about your grandfather?
Well, she did tell me about my grandfather. He used to fish, and he was a fishman too, well, the shrimp boats were prominent back then, and he fished on his own, fishing in the waters here for a living with cast nets and what they call seine nets.
Okay.
And he died at such a young age. Well, when I was young, anyway, he died and left her with raising most of the family, and some of the kids were grown when he died, so they all helped as much as they possibly
okay,
could.
Okay, but fishing was his main way of earning a living.
Yes, fishing and shrimping, yes.
Okay, how about your grandmother? Did she work?
She never worked for anyone that I know of.
Okay.
I don't remember her.
Did she take in laundry, do those kinds of things?
I don't remember her doing that either.
Okay, what was her source of...
Well, mainly from the grown kids and Social Security that I think was in place at the time.
Okay.
When my grandfather passed.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yes.
What interesting memories do you have about your grandmother?
Well, my grandmother was a very strict and stern lady. She was, we had to, every Sunday, well, if not every Sunday, three Sundays out of the month, we were in church, and she was strict about that, being in the house on time, she was very strict about that. When I was coming out, we caught a bus to school, but sometimes we'd walk back from school. School being Peck High School for me. I spent 1 year at Catholic school, which was we used to walk from Old Town to the Catholic school. But I went because of the bus transportation. My second year, I went to public school.
Okay.
And so we caught the bus in the town, and sometimes we'd catch it back, but a lot of times I would walk back from school to be with more kids.
Okay.
Because there wasn't that many children my age in Old Town at the time.
Okay. At the time your grandmother was helping to raise you, she had already moved over from St. Mary's.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. I never knew her when she...
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
She, She moved over here, I think, after she married my grandfather.
Okay.
I think that's what it was.
Was she a church-going lady?
Yes, she was.
She obviously then taught you to go to church.
Yes.
You mentioned she did quite a bit of the job of bringing you up. How did that... your mother married, remarried, and moved to...
My mother remarried in... Well, my mother and father actually never was married. I was born out of wedlock, me and my sister.
Okay.
My mother married, I think, in 47, I believe that's what it was, 47, 48. I'm not sure, one of those 2 years. And then she moved to Jacksonville. My mother did. She would have taken us with her, but my grandmother would have been in the house by herself.
I see.
And I really didn't want to go to Jacksonville.
Okay.
And so I was glad that I stayed in Old Town and raised in Old Town, and that's why I still love this community here.
Okay. Did your grandmother remarry after your grandfather died?
She never remarried.
Yeah. Now, how many other kids were there in the house with you?
Just my sister and I.
Just yourself. Okay.
Yes.
Well, I'm sure you're right. That was a great help to them. Where your grandmother got her clothing? Did she make it? Was she able to buy it?
My grandmother, there was a sewing machine, but I don't remember her doing anything other than repair work.
Okay.
I don't think she made anything. Yeah. But I did have my uncle. He was Henry. He was like 5 or 6 years older than me. He was there too, but him being older. So he had little jobs that he did, and then I had another uncle, Everett, which was maybe 5 or 6 years older than Henry. He went to live in Boston with an uncle that was there.
Okay.
But actually, there was only the three of us in the house.
Okay. When you were old enough to work, you probably contributed to helping your grandmother, give her money you earned and that type of thing.
Yeah, I was old enough to work, but I think around fourth grade I started doing little jobs. I know we had a fish camp in Old Town. It was called Pop Davis's Fish Camp. And I go out and help the guys unload the boat with fish and help them load it up. And my grandmother really never took any money from me. She, you know, if something was needed, then I was there for her. And then I started working on a laundry truck, helping around fourth grade, I think. There was a relative. I used to run clothes for a gentleman. The name was Leon Foster. We called him Shorty Foster.
Okay.
And so he was crippled. He walked with a limp. And so I started helping him on the laundry truck. He couldn't get up and down, so I'd run clothes to people's houses for him.
Okay.
And back then, after school, I don't know, I might have made a quarter or 50 cents, maybe sometime on Saturday, a dollar or two, whatever it was.
That was big money, though,
in
those days.
Yeah.
Sure was.
Yeah, and so...
Do you remember, did your grandmother... These were difficult times for black people, because of all the challenges after the Civil War. Did she help you understand the things you could do and you couldn't do, colored and white bathrooms? And did she talk to you about these kinds of things?
Yes, she did. But growing up in Old Town, in Fernandina period, I guess you might say, out in Old Town, it was a different atmosphere of, with so many of the whites that were there, we were all sort of like in the same boat together. We were all poor together, and they were all fishermen. They worked at the porgy plant. We'd swim together, play baseball together, football together, whatever games we played together, but we went to school separately.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't as much segregation as I've experienced in other areas of the country.
I was very much taken by that when I heard you talk about it the first time. One of the things that made me say, "Gee, I want to talk to Neil."
And
you were a lot happier than maybe black kids in other places, because you had that combination of whites and blacks that all got along well together.
Absolutely, there was one family, the Lucas family. The mother the mother still living, the father has passed away, but. They had television and we didn't, and when I think it was Tuesday night's fight, if I wasn't around there to see the fights, I mean, they were hollering out the window for me to come around, and the mother would fry fish or fry chicken, and if I wasn't eating, what was wrong with me? She was just like a mother.
A second mother?
Yeah.
Okay.
What was wrong? If I didn't come around to watch the fights with them,
okay,
something was wrong.
All right.
Yeah.
But were there any other things you remember her telling you about how the two races should get along, or how things you need to be concerned about or cautioned about?
Well, nothing out of it, nothing I would say that was really that stand out of my mind today. I know being brought up in the Catholic Church, we had St. Peter Claver, which was the black, we call it the black Catholic, yes, Church, and we have St. Michael, who was a white Catholic Church, but we attended Mass together. One Sunday, Mass would be early at St. Peter Claver, which was the black Catholic Church. The blacks would sit in the front, and the white would sit in the
whites back. Who came to St. Peter Claver.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But there was nothing written down. It just seemed like that was the accepted thing to do at
that
the time.
Was your church, so
yeah,
they sat.
Yeah, and so when we went to St. Michael's, we would sit in the back, and the whites would sit up front. And I, being a kid, I never forget, I went to St. Michael's one day, and my Uncle Harry Trey, he would drive us to church, and so I sat up front, and the whites said nothing. They sat beside me, and all of a sudden he came and got me and told me to sit in the back. So I was confused with that, because I wasn't looking at it as being segregated at the time, you know. He was the only one that said anything. No one else said nothing.
Yeah. That's because this was not a problem in Old Town. You didn't really have to think about those kinds of things.
That's right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. tell me a little bit about, your mother married and moved to Jacksonville, and you chose not to go with her because the grandmother would have been left alone, and I understand that.
Yes.
During that time your grandmother was bringing you up, what kind of a relationship did you have with your dad?
Well, he was in and out. I didn't see him that often because he was traveling a lot with the fishing season. They would go from, New York had a plant too, I think. Amagansett, Long Island, New York. They would fish from New York to right along the Atlantic coast all around to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And they would travel with the season. So I didn't really see him that often sometime, maybe 4 or 5 times a year sometimes.
He would
come and go. He always, when I was a real young, people say he always carried me around and showing me off to his buddies, I guess. I guess he was bragging rights, I guess. He had a son. But we didn't have a closer relationship as I would have liked to have had, but being a kid, I didn't understand that until I got older.
Sure.
What?
And that was, as you say, he was gone so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Now, when did he marry Catherine?
He married Catherine. It was in the late 40s.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that was around 47, 48.
Okay.
He married Catherine.
Was that after your mother moved on to Jacksonville to get married?
I'm not sure, but I think it was.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Did you spend time at their house? He and Catherine had a house together.
They had a house together. I'd been to their house several times, but I wasn't. I never spent a lot of time there. He'd come and get me occasionally, and I would go there.
Okay, all right. Your dad, we just talked with George. Your dad came down from somewhere in South Carolina.
Yeah, a place called Charlotte.
Charlotte. How do we spell that for the
Schellotte?
Okay. All right. Okay. How did Catherine and your dad meet?
I really can't answer that question. I don't know.
Okay.
But I guess back then it was I guess it's some social event. I really don't know. I don't know how they met.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, then your mother and your dad had you and your sister, is that correct?
Yes.
And then did your dad and Catherine have children?
They had three children, one boy and two girls.
One boy and two girls,
yes.
Okay. All right. I've got a lot of Catherine's history, so this will obviate me having to ask you about that,
right.
But... did you hear from your dad or from Catherine or from your mother things about a race and things you shouldn't do, and do they have any pet peeves or concerns about all that?
Well, probably more from my mother and from my dad about different things that he had to encounter when he was a young man. I know.
If you share some of that with me, that'd be very helpful.
Yeah, I know when he was fishing. Sometime during the off season when he wasn't fishing, because they didn't fish all 12 months of the year, different areas they moved to, but he would, he also had his own taxi service in Jacksonville. And he worked red cab work in Jacksonville, and then he had a cab service, and he would go from sometime Jacksonville, and he would be in Miami. He had cabs and things. And recently, I say recently, within the last 10 or 15, he died in 94. He was 94 years old when he passed. He told me one of the highlights of him, he drove, I think it was Edgar Bergen's wife from Jacksonville, from Miami to Asheville, North Carolina.
Okay.
He said he did chauffeuring work too.
Sure.
And he drove her from I think it was Jacksonville to Asheville, North Carolina. And he also, he told me, surprisingly, he said he never knew what the Depression was. People were complaining about the Depression. He said he made a lot of money during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
He said because he booked entertainment in the different areas of Florida.
I see.
All across Florida, he said.
Well, no wonder he wasn't home between the fishing and the taxing.
Yeah, he said he booked entertainment. I never heard that before until maybe 10 years ago he told me this. He booked entertainment.
Do you remember any discussions on his part about, for example, did you see the movie Driving Miss Daisy?
Yes. I saw the movie.
Yeah, and he had to stop and
when I saw that movie, I thought about him from what he told me he used to drive people around.
Did he ever tell you any of these things where he'd have to stay somewhere in a different hotel, I guess?
Yeah. They stayed back then. A lot of the black areas had boarding houses, different areas. You could go in different towns, and there was somebody there, black people that had rooming houses for the black entertainers to stay in, the chauffeurs and things of that.
They had to stay somewhere, so that meant somebody made some money and there was space available.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And that's what he did. He was always, I guess you might, we refer to it as hustling, because a lot of the old timers that they know know him, and they find out I'm his son, and some of them would even tell me things how he was always busy doing things.
Yeah.
Can you
think of any more of these things that you might some experiences he shared with you or?
To make money, even when he was on the fish boat after he retired from being the captain of the boat, he would pilot the boat, because he would go to the Gulf up until, I guess he was past 75, and he officially retired in his early 80s, I guess. But the guys on the boat were asking just to come back, just to tell them stories of his experiences, and he loved to sing songs, what they call work songs.
Okay.
And he was a great singer, from what everybody tell me, and I've heard him sing too. He'd have a nice voice. And he kept the guys on the boat working and kept them loose, and they all loved him.
Uh-huh. I mean, he sounded like a wonderful man.
Yeah.
When we listened to George just revered him, and that's why he wanted to meet you.
Yeah.
And it's a compliment to you that he said you're like your dad. So he's been a wonderful person.
Yeah, he even told me one time about some of the prejudice that he met even later in life. He was the only fishboat captain around here, and then one of the
only black fishboat captain, or
he was later he was the first, and then later in life, as the fish industry sort of depleted around the area, he was around, and so occasionally they would take a boat out and he would be the captain. But whoever owned the boat at the time, he told me they wanted him to be the captain, and he had a white engineer, and they wanted, rather than give him the wages that the captains normally got, they wanted him to share the wages with the engineer. So he said he refused. He said he wouldn't do that.
Why would that be? Just because he was black and the engineer was white?
Whoever the white engineer was, I think, didn't want to be subservient to the captain, being a black captain.
Yeah, didn't want the captain to earn more than he earned, I guess.
This is what
so he would refuse those kinds of things.
Yes. Yeah, so he told me he wouldn't do it for that. Uh-huh. Yeah.
These are interesting pieces of black history. Can you remember any other things your dad or your mother might have told you about what I call day-to-day living experiences between blacks and whites?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. He had a way with people of getting along with people. I guess there's so many different ways of opening doors besides having keys. I know I remember one time the sheriff around here that was so notorious in Youngblood. He liked my father too, because one time when I was a young kid, I was stopped for speeding, which I wasn't speeding, but the police thought I was driving somebody else's car. And the police thought that the person that owned the car was driving me, so he was sort of embarrassed when he stopped me, so he gave me this ticket to see the sheriff.
Uh-huh.
rather than so the sheriff found out who I was. And the first thing he said, son, if I tell your daddy you were speeding down the highway, he'd be so mad. And so he just talked to me and told me, said, well, you go ahead and drive careful.
Yes.
But things like that, and he had a way of just getting along with people that even if a person didn't like him, he could sense that, and he would sort of add a little humor to whatever he talked to them, and mm-hmm. and sort of mend a lot of fences that way.
Okay.
Yes.
On his boat, Neil, did he, well, this particular time you're talking about the mate, but normally when he was out fishing or going to the Gulf, was the entire crew black?
No. Back in the 50s, he had... The entire crew consists of either 22 men or 26. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But it'd be three or four white guys, and some of them living today. I know a couple of the Lucases. They fish with him, and they love him to death. They would tell me I'm fishing with your daddy or something like that.
Did you ever hear your dad talk about problems he may have had with some of the white crew members?
Never heard him.
Never had. Okay, that's a credit to him.
Yes,
that sure is.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right. Where was your dad educated?
He didn't have an education. He's a self-taught mode, okay. You know. And with my sisters, after he was married to Catherine, my sisters, I know they helped him with a lot of reading and writing. And
these are your half-sisters?
Half-sisters, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
They helped him with a lot of things, and I guess other people did too, like George Davis helping him with some uh-huh. things that he needed to get over.
Did he have enough education to read his maps and charts and things? Okay.
Well, I think some of the charts, yes, he could read them, and but not a lot of them.
He would have someone there on the boat who could help him read them, I suppose, or he didn't need to know.
I guess it was through self-experience. A lot of things, I know, because I've been on the boat with him a couple of times, and when you learn to, the certain areas they went in was just everyday areas. It wasn't no new territory per se.
Yeah.
It
uh-huh.
was just a repetitive type of of navigating that they did.
Well, I give him a lot of credit. I mean, I'm sure the first time that he headed south to go around the Keys and into the Gulf, that probably was a challenge for him.
Yes.
You have to lay, yes, you're right. You said that's self-experience.
Yeah.
I remember your mother or your stepmother showing me the citation that he got from the Navy for observing, I guess, watching for submarines and so forth. Did you ever hear him talk about his wartime experiences?
Never heard him talk about it. I think only later, after it all was over with, maybe once he might have mentioned it.
He never. As there were U-boats around, and in fact, George tells a story about some fellows getting off a U-boat in a dinghy and going to a local, what might be called a 7-Eleven, buying some food and going back to the boat.
No kidding. Oh, my.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I've heard about U-boats being around.
Was anybody in your family, when you were a youngster, involved in World War II that you know of?
Yeah, oh yes. My uncle, Herman Trad, Top
Herman.
From Top, he was involved.
Okay.
And a couple other uncles by marriage, they were in World War II.
Okay.
Yes.
Did you hear them talk about experiences as black people among white people when they were away in the military?
Not that much. I know they were the black military base camp. Basically, was I hear all the talk about Huachuca, which was in Arizona, I think.
It was all black camp.
For Fort Huachuca, I think it is. Arizona was all black.
Do you remember how to spell that? Just for the sake of the transcription.
I don't know how to spell that.
Okay, yeah. we'll just wing that.
Yes.
Yes. Harry Truman desegregated the armed forces during the Korean War, which was after World War II. World War II was a segregated situation.
Yes.
Do you know whether your dad and or your stepmother and your mother, did they vote?
Yes, they did. They did vote. Yes.
Did you ever hear them talking about such things as literacy tests or poll taxes or things that the whites used to throw in the way of people to keep them from voting?
No, I never heard them mention that.
Okay, so if they wanted to vote, they were able to do that.
Yes.
Okay. Did your dad or your mother or your stepmother ever talk to you about slavery and the Civil War and these kinds of things?
No, I never. My father. He was the oldest I'm not sure of how many children. I think his father was married twice. I remember saying that he was the oldest of between two marriages that his father had of 26. The first wife, I think, had 15 children.
That's a lot of kids.
And I think the other one had 10. And he didn't really know all of his sisters and brothers.
Yeah.
Because he left home at a young age, and for some reason, another if he went back, he didn't stop to see all of them. He might have passed through and might have saw one or two, but I know he didn't go back to see all of the others.
Okay. So they never really talked about that either. And you think, and it's interesting, I will talk to some good black folks who will have a lot of memories of things that their parents or grandparents have told them about past history, Civil War, slavery, convict leasing, and that. Do you know what convict leasing is?
No, I can't say that.
Convict leasing, and maybe after I tell you, perhaps you have learned something about that. If a black person was arrested, and he was put in jail.
Right.
If a turpentine company or a lumber company needed some labor,
yes,
they would pay the police to, they would lease that person to take them out into the turpentine business or the lumber business, and they'd work, and the pay for that would go back to the police department or the county. That was called convict leasing.
Yes.
And that was very severe stuff.
Yes.
People were abused, and a lot of people died. I mean, they didn't care. The authorities didn't care.
Yes.
They'd work some to death.
Oh, my.
Did you ever hear anything?
I never heard about that one, no.
That was very difficult stuff. Let's come back to your mom again. Even though she married and moved on to Jacksonville, she had children as well, I guess.
Yes.
But her marriage. Did you see them socially a lot?
Oh, yes, yes. We would go to Jacksonville on the weekend, or they would come back over here.
That'd be you and your sister, maybe?
Me and my sister. And I would spend many nights in Jacksonville with my mother. And,
okay.
And then they would bring us back here, and we'd go to the beach together.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, when they brought you back here, you came back by car?
By car.
And you'd come up 17?
Yeah, that's right, 17.
And across?
Yeah. And years ago, they had a bus that ran from Fernie Jack called Mac Junkin.
How do you spell that?
MCJUNKKINE, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Mac Junkin.
Okay.
Mac Junkin.
Now, that's the first I've heard of that.
The bus station is where the antique shop is across from the Blue Moon Cafe. Behind the Palace Bar.
Oh, okay. That was the bus station.
That was the bus station there.
So the bus ran both ways.
Yes.
It probably ran to other places too. Did it go?
No, anyone going up 17, going to Jacksonville, it would pick up. It would turn left there at Yulee.
Okay.
17, and anyone that's going to Jacksonville, and you stand out there and flag the bus down, or anyone on Main Street in Jacksonville coming to Fernina.
Okay.
They would pick you up.
Did you have to change buses?
No.
Oh, I see. Okay. I've heard people like Maveen talking about that run from Jacksonville up 17 through Yulee and across here was not a happy one.
No, because you had to sit in the back of the bus, and then if any depending on how many whack was on the bus, you didn't have a seat if they were
They'd ask you to get off.
No, well you stand. I've never experienced getting off. You stand up.
Yeah. Okay. The bus was never that full where they
ask you to
get off.
No.
I've heard people say that Yulee was not a good place.
I've heard that too, but I've never experienced that. I can't. I've heard it, through word of mouth.
Yeah. Okay.
But
okay.
I can't.
Did you have any concerns for your own personal well-being riding that bus through?
I've never had any personal concerns. Growing up in Old Town, I tell you, even as a younger teenager, I was alone a lot.
Yeah.
Because I played football and I played baseball, and I would walk and go anywhere I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. I never had any mm-hmm. real problem.
Okay. When you were ill, if you ever were ill, how did you get health care?
Well, Dr. Lungenheiser was my doctor.
Lungenheiser.
Yes, and I never had any problem. I go to his office, and naturally he had a white waiting room and a black waiting room. But he was, being a German doctor, I don't know why, everybody loved him so much. And he would, so if you go to some of the other white doctors, then you might be in that office all day. But with him, he would take one white and one black.
I see. Okay, he was white?
Yes, he was.
Okay.
Yes.
And he lived right here?
Lived here.
Interesting. Never heard that gentleman's name.
He was German descent.
Okay.
And he was a very, very handsome doctor, sort of like a Clark Gable type of individual.
Okay.
And he was well liked by everybody.
Did he come to the house?
He would come to the house, yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
And if you needed to be in the hospital, if you ever were...
I never was. I was born in Jacksonville, in Brewster Hospital.
Okay, yes. Okay.
And then he would come to the house, but I've never had to spend any time in the hospital.
Okay, okay.
Yes.
How about, did anyone in the family, your brothers or sisters, from Catherine or your mother, or keep a diary?
Not, my brother in Jacksonville does. He keeps a diary.
Okay.
Yeah,
have you ever had a chance to look through it?
No, I haven't, but he has a lot of, his entire room is with a lot of history stuff.
This is from my
mother.
Your mother and her second marriage?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. What did you folks do, your grandmother or your father or any of you, in terms of vacation? Did you ever go anywhere?
No, never vacationing. We would just, every summer I can remember, we would maybe once or twice during the summer, we would go to American Beach.
Okay.
More than once or twice, but we had like one big family picnic.
Okay.
And everybody would bring the dishes, their specialties, or whatever they wanted to make, and we would be right on American Beach, right on the corner of Lewis and right facing the ocean. They had a big pavilion there, and the big pavilion had a like a big porch right around it. And it'd be more than our family, might be four or five other families there picnicking, going in the water, coming back, and
you look forward to that.
Oh yes,
that was a fun time.
Yeah, that was a fun time. Yes.
Were there ever any problems out there that you remember? Fights or?
Oh, there were fights, I can't say that with our family, but the police was there. In the 50s, I think we had our first black deputy sheriff back in 1950, I think it was, 50 or 51. And that was his territory, and he had his deputies with him.
Were his deputies usually black, or was...
They were black.
So they would assign black sheriff people out there to...
Yes, and you had black and white there.
Okay.
But
were the problems basically between the blacks, a little bit too much drinking?
Yeah, a little bit too much drinking.
Yeah, okay.
And a lot of the problems was like some of the blacks would drink and they would try to drive the cars, and they would stop them even if they weren't doing anything wrong, just stop them, and if they smelled whiskey, they would lock them up. That was the most racism I saw, I think, was with the police department.
I see. Okay.
Because I think, I don't know for sure, but I think the policemen made some type of incentive off of how many people they would lock up.
I see.
You know,
I see.
They would lock five people up, and the fines were $25 a piece, and they would maybe get $5 off that. I'm not
I
sure
see.
About that.
Yeah.
I tend to ask some of the guys I know who was working for the police department then, but I never did, but I heard that that's the way it was.
With the black deputies out there, did that help?
It helped some, but in a ways it didn't, because I think lack of education, lack of understanding of different situations created, because it gave people that macho mentality,
yeah,
and the least little thing that was said. Sometime if the police himself or the deputy had a little more education to deal with it, but he sort of take things personally. Sometimes when people are drinking and carrying on, you take things personally and you overreact to
a
lot of things.
Sure.
I think that's what.
Well, even so, you enjoyed going out there, and these were just common things in life, I guess.
Right.
They weren't.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Were there ever any interferences on the part of whites when you were out there?
Believe it or not, back in the 50s, I can remember, even in the early 60s, before this integration really came about, a lot of whites would come down there and be on American Beach. And they used to drag. We had some of the blacks ran drag racing on the beach, cars,
and
it started with the blacks, even with the cars and motorcycles, and then the whites came, And they joined right in, and the blacks still ran it. You know, they would challenge, one guy would challenge another one. They would race down the beach if they had motorcycles or the cars. And then what really stopped, and then a lot of the white girls got involved, I can remember, even though I wasn't here during some of the time, but I would come back, and the police stopped it because a lot of the blacks and whites started mingling more.
Yes.
And so they stopped them from drag racing. They blame it on something else, as they never had no real accident, I can remember.
This kind of thing would upset the white male.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. He'd be jealous of
right.
The
girls. The girls would be out in their swimsuits and bikinis or whatever, if they had them back then. And the sort of police department stopped them from drag racing on the beach, which were, they were just having fun. There was, I don't know of any accident or anybody really getting hurt.
Sure.
Bad from
sure.
That.
Yeah. Well, it was just folks trying to have fun together. Were there ever any brawls between the blacks and the whites because of this? Do you
not
know?
That I can remember. Yeah. Not that I can remember.
Okay. So and so they came down there just to have fun and race and so forth,
right.
And
then right.
Girls and drinking, and then things just happened. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you personally afraid of? You were born in 41, so you were a young man at the time. You know, Rosa Parks in 54, and
yeah.
Martin Luther King and the St. Augustine riots. Did these things bother you? Well, they obviously bothered you, but
yeah. Well, I read about them in you know on the news and television, but we didn't. After a couple of experiences around here, I think my niece. Well, she was the first. Like I said, she was the first black kid that went to the parish school over here.
Okay.
And I don't know if anyone ever tracked it for sure or not, but I think someone shot at the house or into the house or something where we lived in Old Town, where she lived in Old Town. But I don't think they ever found a bullet, so they don't know if it was a firecracker or a shot.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, I heard it was a shot, but I've never gotten to the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm.
But she still went to school here, and then she went on to public school later on.
Okay.
And when I was in school in the 50s, I was in a band, but I wasn't in the social band that played social function. And some friends of mine, they were in a band, and so they played all the function. And so they were invited to play for the white group at what they called the Jetty Lodge, which was in the Fort Clinch area.
Jetty.
J-E-T-T-Y. Jetty.
Okay. Jetty Lodge.
Yeah, Jetty Lodge.
Okay.
It's right not too far from the pier.
Okay.
Out there. And so they got some threatening calls from, I guess, people who say they were the Ku Klux Klan or something, and told them if they play out there what they were going to do. So some of the families got concerned, and they went to Sheriff Youngblood with it. And he told them, point blank, he said, don't worry about it. He said, the Ku Klux Klan are not coming into my town. He said, this is my town. He said, the band is going to play. And he sent the deputies to escort the band to the Jetty Lodge and back home.
Okay.
I remember that's back in the 50s.
So, okay, he was a good person then.
In some ways, I would say yes. In other words, a lot of people hated his guts, and he was, you know.
Yeah, I've heard both sides. I've heard particularly black women. He would kick them, and it doesn't fit what you're telling me, though.
Yeah, I've heard these things too, but my experience wasn't that. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Someone come in.
Someone came in.
Oh, no, that's okay. It's probably the caretaker.
Yes.
Are you familiar with the problems they had at the mill back in those days? Let me tell you what I've heard. There was a black union, if you will.
Yeah, there was two different unions.
Yeah, and they were agitating a little bit for more money, and apparently the people who owned the mill up north had sent word down that if there are problems, we'll close it down. Everybody will lose the job. There was some fighting. I think there were a couple of people killed. And do you have any knowledge of any of that?
I don't remember anybody being killed about the fightings or not. But I do know there was a difference. The whites didn't make as much as the blacks at the mill. They had two separate unions, a black union and a white union. And but I don't remember any fighting. Anyone got killed from the mill discrepancies. Mm-hmm. later on, and someone did file a class action suit against the mill for discrimination on upgrading of the blacks and the wage, and the guys that worked at the mill, they got some money from it. Now what they got, I don't know, but
I did hear
this is a fact that they did get some money from it.
I'll pursue this a little further. I had heard that the white union members, talk to the black union members and say something to the effect, we know you want to earn more money, but if you press for more money, the guys up north are going to close the whole thing down, we'll all be out of work. And this was a, this caused a controversy between blacks and whites.
I didn't hear.
Well, you felt then, talk back to Sheriff Youngblood, you felt the law pretty well protected you then.
Being the young man that I was, I felt that it did. I know a lot of blacks, well, they hated Youngblood but Guts, but I didn't have those bad experiences. But I do know blacks that did with him. You know,
probably depended a lot on how the individual black or white person conducted themselves, whether or not they were working and were a good citizen and so forth. I would guess.
Yeah.
How about the western part of the county? Did you ever hear of experiences over in Callahan or Hilliard that might be considered racial problems?
I've heard nothing that I could really jog my memory not to say, but I've often heard of things that's happening out there that was the so-called redneck area, and you know, blacks knew their places out there. It wasn't the same. Atmosphere in Fernandina wasn't the same as out in the county, where people could do things out there and get away with more things than they could here in the city. But I can't just pinpoint any one thing and say.
Okay. Yeah. So, but there was a difference.
Between
the way blacks and whites got along in the West, as opposed to the way they got along in Fernandina.
Yes, there was.
Can you describe your grandmother's house?
Well. Yes, my grandmother's house had, it was, we had a big living room, a kitchen, and two bedrooms. Younger in life, we all had outhouses then, but back in the 50s, we had indoor plumbing. You know, we added that to the house.
Did you have electricity?
We had electricity.
Okay.
Yeah, we had electricity, yes, we did.
Do you remember in your lifetime, Neil, living in a place that didn't have electricity?
No, I can't. Okay. I can't say that I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you do remember outhouses.
Yeah. We had a wood stove.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the things you did to earn money when you were young, other than working on the laundry truck. What other things were you? Did you work for your dad at all?
No, I never experienced working on a fish boat. I've been out with him on the boat just for the experience of going out and watching him catch fish and hear them sing their work songs and the fun that they had. And I would help to cook what they call a mess boy. I wasn't a mess boy, but I would help to cook in the kitchen, you know. On the boat?
Yeah.
But when I was in 10th grade in school, I started working for Allen's Department Store.
Was there
right downtown now where Parton's is.
Okay.
West of Parton's. Allen owned all of the stores west of Parton. Which now it's a law office and a tax place. And
was that Allen?
Allen's.
Okay.
Yes, Allen's.
Allen's, okay.
Yes. I worked for Andrew Allen, the old man Allen. I remember him as a kid, but he died before I started working for the store.
Okay.
And he had, which was a wonderful family to work for. The son works at the post office now, but his father's retired and is at home. But I remember very well working for them. I used, after school, I would clean up and you know, keep things stocked up and straightened up.
Okay.
And when I started playing football, even I didn't show up, he would permit me to, you know, come in when I had time and do things, and which was a good experience for me. And I never forget. Sometimes they got busy in there back in the 50s, and somebody needed to be waited on. I would wait on them and close the sale on different things, and you know, but I wasn't getting. The salesman back then, they got a percentage of whatever they sold.
You just got to help
out. I just got to help out and you know, with things like that.
Tell me a little bit about your education.
When I finished high school here in 59, my intentions were to...
Was that Peck? Or was
Peck High. Peck High School, yes.
Okay.
My intentions, I was scheduled to go to Bethune-Cookman College in Daytona, and we went down there. We were supposed to get a football scholarship. It was myself and three other classmates of mine, we were playing football, and the coach at the time came to us with a scenario that the school didn't have the money to support.
It's Bethune-Cookman?
Bethune-Cookman.
Okay.
Didn't have the money to support all of the athletes, and that during the football season, we could stay on campus, but after football season, we had to find our own place. And so I got to thinking, I knew I could have done it, but I didn't want to put my family through no extra burden of having to take money from basically, which was my mother and stepfather at the time, make the sacrifice with the other children. So I said, I'm not going to do it. I think I can make it on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And so I left and came back to Jacksonville, and I worked the shipyard for a little while. I was still 18 years old at the time. Gibbs Shipyard in Jacksonville. And so my aunt that lived in New Jersey, she asked me if I want to come up there. So I said, sure. So she sent me an application for RCA, and I filled it out and sent it back. So I left here I think it was October of 59, around the 18th or 19th on a Saturday, and I started work that following Monday at RCA in Morristown, New Jersey. And I worked in
Morristown?
Morristown, New Jersey. Moores.
Moores.
M-O-R-E-S.
Okay.
Yes. That's South Jersey.
Okay.
Cherry Hill area.
Okay. Yeah.
Philadelphia's right there.
Okay.
And and so I started working for them, and I worked for them for, I guess, off and on for like 3 or 4 years, because they had government contracts back then. And so you get laid off, and I would always come back to Florida. I got laid off, and I'd come back to Florida, and I would draw unemployment.
Okay.
And a lot of people here, they weren't familiar with unemployment, and so they didn't know what I was doing, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I went back to RCA, and then I got laid off again. So then I think I left them. I started working at a steel mill, a precision drawn steel company. And so I went to a couple of tech schools doing something, electronics or something, but then I got laid off, so I couldn't really afford to continue that. When I was working, I was making, well, fairly decent money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked for the steel plant after that. I left RCA, and then I worked for a U.S. pipe foundry where they were making pipe. And I never was one to just not to do nothing after I got laid off.
Mm-hmm.
From there. So I kept applications other places. And so after I left the pipe foundry, I didn't really leave. I had other applications, so I was called for Bud Company, Bud.
Okay.
Automotive, which is in Philadelphia.
And you mentioned them this morning. You went on to retire.
Yes. I spent 31 years with them, and I retired. Even working for Bud, I worked other places doing things. Just
when you had free time.
Free time, yes.
Let me ask you an interesting question here. There were two very significant migrations of black people from the South to the North. One was after World War I, and the other was after World War II. And the stimulus for that was there just wasn't an opportunity to earn decent money in the South for most black people, so they go North to get better jobs and earn more money.
Right.
Was that part of you? Were you familiar? If this is 59, you graduated, so this is a little bit after World War II, but were you taken by the opportunity maybe to go north and make more money? Was this something you knew about?
It was. I didn't have that in mind when I went north. I guess if my aunt and uncle wasn't there, I probably wouldn't have gone.
I see.
But I wanted a change, and after she said working with RCA and being a young, I was 18 years old at the time, and I knew about RCA, the radio people and stuff like that. I didn't know what I'd be doing. And so I wanted a change at the time, and I wasn't particularly all that enthused about leaving the South, but it was a change.
Yeah.
I guess if they lived in Atlanta, I'd have wanted to go into Atlanta.
I see. Okay. Did you know of people who went north for better jobs?
Oh, yes. You know? Yeah. In my own family, a lot of my family went, they lived in the Massachusetts area, Boston.
Okay.
Yeah, I had one uncle. He was a pharmacist there, and so he started a migration from my own personal family. My uncle went there, and
pretty much after World War II.
Yeah. And some of them still live there.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. That was an interesting period.
Yes.
Can you tell me how you went north? How old were you when you went north?
18.
Eighteen.
Yes.
And you had been here long enough to understand the way the two races got along together and how things worked and so forth. Yeah. And then you went up there. Can you give me a comparison of how the young black man here and then the young black man up there?
Well, believe it or not, I found more segregation in the North, in my opinion, than I found living here in the South. It was a different type of segregation because I was used to living right here. We lived in this area. We lived in sort of mixed neighborhoods here in Florida. And then when I went north, I saw a lot of segregated neighborhoods. You know,
did you live in one of those segregated neighborhoods?
Yes, I did. Uh-huh. I lived in Merchantville, New Jersey, which is a part of Cherry Hill area. And they used to call it the black area. They call it Matchtown.
Matchtown.
And if I understand that, years ago there was a factory there that made matches.
I see.
So they call it Matchtown.
Okay.
And so... So
someone mentioned Matchtown. That's the place where the blacks lived up there.
The place where the blacks lived. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Can you talk more for me about the differences between the two?
I worked... the difference between the two was on the job. I saw promotions and things that was
discrimination.
Discrimination.
Yeah.
And it comes in all forms because at RCA you had a lot of families that lived there. And I guess if black families was in charge, I would promote my uncle and my brother too before I would promote someone that I didn't know.
I see.
You know, it was wrong because they had government contracts, but people were looking out for family members.
Sure.
There was nepotism,
yes,
you know, going on, and I saw that an awful lot. And to tell you the truth, when I first went there, the first people that I befriended was three Italian young men, and two were brothers, one was not. And they used to take because the Morristown plant was so full, they could only have like 10% production workers, and the rest 90% had to be office personnel. So they had a satellite plant, which was in Croydon, Pennsylvania. And to me, going to Croydon, Pennsylvania, I might as well had been in some part of southern Georgia or some outline of Florida, because it was all white, and they were basically working class of white. And the first time that I ever was called a nigger directly to my face was in Croydon, Pennsylvania.
Is that right?
The first time we were in a pool. In a bar shooting pool, we'd go to get sandwiches after work and we'd shoot pool, and the two Italian boys, three Italian boys, and this one white lady, and she was drinking at the time, whether she was an alcoholic or not, I couldn't say that, but she said to them, "What are you doing shooting pool with that nigger," or something like that. And so they put her out of the bar.
Great.
Yeah, the bar, they put her out of the bar, yeah.
Great.
Yeah. But I never had no really physical encounters, anything like that.
This was an isolated thing you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. When you got up there, did they have such things as colored and white restrooms?
And I didn't see the colored and white restrooms in the North. No, I didn't see that. Not where I was.
Okay.
But working for the Bud Company, I started in 1965, and they had two bars, and there was, I guess. And when you walked in the bar, all of the for like lunchtime or anything, they had a shot and a beer and soup and sandwiches already set up, and they were set up at stools, and all of the stools were white workers at Bud Company. And every day, this is what they did. And so the black workers, they weren't everyday regulars, I guess you might say, and they had to stand up or something. And there was this segregation that was going on there. All of the black workers would tell us. Tell me, being a young man, they would tell me about things that happened there.
I see. And so this was in this segregation was imposed by the white workers.
White workers and the bar owner. One was called Old Boyle's, and I forgot the other one's name, but they were it wasn't a written thing, but some of the black workers were made felt unwanted because they had so many white workers who would come there every day.
I see.
To eat
I
and
see.
Drink.
Okay. Yeah. Can you think of any other differences that you experienced up there being a young black man?
Well, on my job, I was the first. They started an apprenticeship program for what they call die setting, machine shop and working with dies. And so I was the first black apprentice that started this program there. They had another young man, but he quit.
I see.
So okay. I was the first black die setting apprenticeship for the Bud Company, which started in 1965. Mm-hmm. And so we went to school for like 18 months, and then had a 6-month probation period. And essentially what going to school really teaches you is sort of like sort of industrial management and things,
see,
and things
okay,
of that.
Okay.
They teach about the dyes and things, but uh-huh. but they had a continued education program, and they have different seminars, and they would bring different people in from outside into the to the plant, and you had to attend these classes and things, and it was real. Well, I was glad that I did, and believe it or not, I would have gotten laid off and might not have stayed there. But one of the white workers, I'll forget it, one of my bosses, I can't think of his name right now, but he told me, he said you're a good worker, and he said you probably get laid off. He said, well, I want you to go over there and take this test for dye setting, and make you. I didn't know what a dye setter was taking. I didn't know what I was taking a test for. And so sure enough, I took the test, and I guess with his word, whether I passed it or not, they put me into the dye setting class.
So that protected your employment then?
Yeah, it protected my employment. Yeah. And for that, the whole 24 months, people got laid off, but I was in the program, so I didn't get laid off.
Okay. Did you feel, Neil, that those work opportunities up there were more favorable for a young black person?
I think they were. I would say yes.
Yeah,
okay. they were more favorable.
It'd be difficult for you to find the same kind of work anywhere down here.
Right. Plus, in the auto industry back then, until today, so the auto industry, they're on like a 6 or 7 day week schedule.
Yeah.
Very few of the auto plants, they have to really be not selling cars or trucks for them to be on a 5 day schedule in order for them to fulfill their orders. And so working a 6 or 7 day work schedule, everybody's making decent money, and you don't have time to like think about the bad times and things are at your disposal that normally wouldn't be at people that were being laid off. And even then, working the 2 years that I didn't get laid off, when you got laid off, we had a fund you could collect unemployment, plus we had a workers' compensation fund that came from the company.
Okay.
And if whatever the unemployment figures were, you might get another $100, or if you had children, it might be $150 from the company.
Okay.
A sub, we call it sub benefits.
Okay.
So which made it a lot easier than a lot of places.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Did you send money home?
Yes, I did. I sent but.
To your grandmother?
To my grandmother, and I'd come down, I would give her money. But she wasn't a person that would really ask for anything.
You had to. Yeah, that's why you wanted to give her something, because she wouldn't ask for it. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Okay, so you came back home when you retired.
I came back home when I retired. And even when I worked every year, I'd come back home two or three times a year. Sometimes.
Yeah, and you mentioned you were here when you did have a period when you were laid off. You'd come home and draw unemployment.
Yes.
What changes did you notice when you came home in terms of the way blacks were able to get along in the community or earn a living or how they related to whites? What you must have seen changes.
Yeah, a lot of changes. And I think what's happening, in my opinion, a lot of other people, the older blacks, naturally, they're going to segregate themselves. But I didn't expect it from some of the younger blacks. The younger blacks, they stay here and they don't leave, and so they don't see the opportunity that's presented to them now. And a lot of them basically segregates themselves in a lot of ways. The guys that work at the mill now, they make real decent wages. And some of them, they don't sort of expand their lives. They just work and come back home, and they seem to be satisfied in the same old mold, doing the same thing day after day.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you talk to them, and they're just satisfied doing what they're doing, and they don't get out and mingle with people, or they don't, mm-hmm. Socialize. If they go to church and they go to work, and that's it. That's mm-hmm. That's their life.
That's sad in a way. Yes.
Yes, it is. There's so much.
Yeah. You've hit on something that I wanted to ask you about. In my experience at work, I encouraged blacks to work hard, to to marry, raise families, get for more education, and so forth. But particularly in our cafeteria, I always saw the good black folks would all go sit together.
Right.
As much as we wanted them to sit with us, what kind of psychology is going on there?
I've often, and sometimes we sit together and we'd be talking about that very same thing.
Would you?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and when I went to the Bud Company, I didn't know anybody at the plant, to tell you the truth. Some of the guys knew ones that had grew up in Philadelphia together in certain areas. And I would even sit by myself there, one of the older guys, and God bless him if he's still living, I think he still is, he would call him and say, "Come on and sit by me, Jitterbug," or something like that, and we'd talk.
They called you Jitterbug?
Yeah. He worked at the Bud Company. He was an oiler. His name was Gregory. And he was, he worked for an undertaker after work, sometime when he had bodies and things, and plus he was a mason, he was 33 degrees, and he was sitting, and I got a lot of insight from him. He uneducated, but he was very, very...
Street smart.
And I learned a lot from him. Uh-huh. And to this day, I thank him for a lot of, I guess, staying at Buzz was part to do with what he, some things that he told me about his company.
Well, tell me a little bit. If you notice me, I will go sit down with blacks where we are. I enjoy that.
Right.
And, it's my little way to say, hey, we're all here together.
That's right.
Tell me more about that psychology. Why is it when blacks here in this hall, for example, they'll all sit together. If they know they're welcome to sit with anybody they want to, why did they do that?
I think it's It sort of have trickled down to the younger blacks too, but the older blacks feel like that was their place.
It's still there.
Because of the segregation.
And
it sort of trickled down with some of the younger blacks too, and some of them don't really know why.
Yeah.
You know, rather because and when I went north, I was that same way. To tell you the truth, I can think back when I first went. Working at RCA, they had a basketball team, and I wasn't a basketball player. I played a little bit, but I wasn't nowhere near because I like baseball and football, and I didn't have time to play basketball. And so I used to go to, we had a little team, and I was on it, and I went to a couple other games at RCA. And so there was one particular white girl, her boyfriend played basketball. And I forget, when I first went up there, we were sitting in the stands, and she called me. She said, "Come sit with me," you know. And I'm looking. I'm the only black there. And I said, "That's okay. I'll sit right here," you know, because down here, in the South, you knew about the mixing of the races and things, and you didn't want to give people the wrong idea.
Yeah.
And so it's something probably that's instilled in a lot of blacks' minds.
It's ingrained.
Ingrained. And down here, it trickles down with the young people. That and hopefully we'll outgrow it.
Yeah, you mentioned one sensitivity. If there's anything that does irritate a redneck male, it's one of his women being close to a black male.
Right, and even.
So that's what was going through your mind.
You're right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know that her call to you to come sit down beside her was innocent and honest.
Right.
But you didn't know who around her might be.
Right. And then her boyfriend even got jealous because she evidently she liked me a little, but I think it's a friendship to me.
Yes.
And when I started playing basketball, like I had a watch and a ring, which probably wasn't worth $50. So she being the only person I knew and the only one that befriended me, I would give it to her to hold for me at the games. And so one day I noticed, I don't know, the boyfriend got jealous or something, but the coach, name was John Musinelli, I never forget. The boyfriend was jealous because the girl was befriending me, but I took it only as a
friendship.
Yeah, friendship. Yeah, even when I played softball, that was my game, playing baseball and football. Those were two of my better sports. I loved baseball.
I bet you were good at it. You're a big boy.
In baseball, I wanted to be a professional baseball player. That's what I wanted to be. I worked out with the Washington Senators at the time. They used to spring train here, the farm system.
Okay.
And I worked there a couple of days with them. But if you didn't know, a scout didn't know you, and I didn't really have all of the training that some of the other kids had. They played, you know, for the recognition, so I didn't stay.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
But even on the baseball team, this girl befriended me, but I just took it at that. Her boyfriend was a catcher, and I never said nothing out of the way to her.
So. Yeah. So that's a good explanation, Neil. I can understand that. We all have to work to see if we can't have good black people know that we enjoy having them sit with us, you know?
Right.
But,
The Buck Company sent me to school out in Detroit. This was back in the early 90s, 89 or 91. And the first day in class there, I guess it maybe was maybe 75 of us anyway, from throughout the Buck Company thing. And so the director, his name was Bill Graham, by the way, and he said, sit beside somebody you don't know, you know. And we all did. And it just so happened the guy sat beside, we've been, somehow we got hooked up, we came together, and for some reason or other we were the last. And so, but that made you, each time you go sit beside somebody you don't know, and then you talk, and you get to know one another. But anyway, the white gentleman, he's from Pennsylvania, and he grew up in the Amish type of community. He wasn't Amish, but his family, and
And right now he treats me like a brother, and he thanked me for helping him. We were in Detroit together, and we went over to Canada together. He told me, he said, "I'm going to stick with you because I've never been out before." Yeah. You know, and he was married at 18, his wife, and raising a family, and he really was green. Yeah, I mean, and he thanked me so much for befriending him.
That makes you feel good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's come back to Fernandina for just a moment as we wrap this up in the next few minutes. You were born in 41.
41, yes.
So, you know, by 50, you were 8 or 9 years old, reasonably worldly.
Right.
What do you remember about the Klan here in Fernandina Beach?
Believe it or not, nothing that was directed at the black community per se, other than I told you about the sheriff, and the phone calls came from the Klan. But I can remember when I worked at Allen's store, in 1957, the Klan marched. They marched downtown Fernandina. They had the hoods on, but the face wasn't covered, and they had the candles. And that was my first time ever seeing the Klan. And me and Mr. Allen stood side by side outside on the sidewalk. It was dark. You know, it just gotten dark, but the store closed 8 or 9 o'clock that night. And he said, "This is my first too." He was talking to me. I'm just 14, 15 years old. And I'm looking to see if I could recognize anybody. But they didn't have the face all covered, but they had the candles, and they just marched through Center City and around and back up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. Now, there was a family I remember, I talked to older people, this is a known fact, there was a white family that lived on 14th Street. We used to call them the name, somebody said people call people the Dirty Dozen or the Humdingers or something. People referred to him as that. And I heard that this particular white fellow didn't take care of his family, and that the Klan came and took him out in the woods and beat him and tarred and feathered him, didn't kill him.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a
white man.
This was a white man. Yeah. And I mentioned that to some of the older blacks here since I've been back, yeah. And they said that was true.
Mm-hmm.
I forget their name, but they live on 14th Street. Right there is a market out there on the right-hand side of 14th Street, but they live right back in that way.
Okay.
But I never remember the Klan any direct harm to the blacks here,
okay.
But the Klan was here.
Were you frightened?
Not really, because I stood as close to them than I am to you right now.
Yeah. Okay.
I was a matter of 2-3 feet, and just looking at it to see if I could recognize anyone.
Okay. Other than marching and this story you've just told me, did you ever hear of anything that they did that didn't see?
Not here on the island, not at all.
Yeah. I've heard that they would go into churches on Sunday and give money to the churches. Have you ever heard that?
I never heard that before.
Never heard that.
Never heard that.
And I don't know whether it was blacks, black churches, white churches, or both.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. The Emancipation Proclamation. You've heard me mention this a couple times. This was the proclamation in January 1st, 1963, where Lincoln offered freedom to blacks.
Right.
Can you remember church celebrations or community celebrations of the proclamation by blacks on New Year's Day or New Year's Eve?
I don't remember any celebrations. No, I don't.
Okay.
No.
I've heard stories about the watchmen in the churches, and the watchman is asked what time it is, and they progressively identify the time right down till midnight, and then there's prayers, I guess, and songs.
Yeah, you know, growing up in a Catholic church down here is sort of different from the Baptist church, because the experience is a lot different. And somehow or another, I wish that I was a Baptist rather than a Catholic, because you sort of feel more like you belong.
You've missed some things.
I feel like I missed a whole lot in life.
Yeah.
I feel like I missed it, because each time I've been to, you know, I went to one of my uncles. He's a minister down in his cousin. He's a minister in Melbourne, Florida. But I went to meet some of my father's family in North Carolina last year, and his sermon was on silent frustration, and it sort of really hit the point with me, and a lot of things that I didn't experience that I wish I had.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The NAACP. I've talked to John L. Prelu and some other people around town, but what do you remember about them? They're still active.
They're
obviously
still active now. When I was a young kid around here, other than knowing the call initials for that, I don't remember any dealings with it per se. I remember going to Peck High School. We always had the secondhand buses, you know, the buses that the white kids was going there mm-hmm. to do it. They got new buses, we got their buses. Mm-hmm. And there was one black man right here that, the superintendent back then was Wiesner, back then in the 50s. And there's one black man, the name was Sam Brown, and I forget, tall, wiry, thin guy. I mean, he always would speak his mind. And they tell me he went to one meeting, and everybody, whites and black, talked about how he jumped on Wiesner and told him that the blacks was tired of getting these secondhand buses and secondhand books with pages torn out of them, and it was time for a change, and they wanted new buses. And the results of what he's saying, within a reasonable period, we began to get new buses. So
now this was a black man.
Black man. Yeah, name was Sam Brown. Now, I'll never forget him. I can see his
face. Do you know? Was he associated with the NAACP?
If he was, I don't
know.
I don't. His wife still lives. I forgot his, but she still lives on. Was living on Nye Street, I believe, but she still lived. But he wasn't an educated man. I think he worked at one of the mills, I believe. But he would speak his mind.
Mm-hmm. And well, good for him.
Yes,
good for him. There was a black business area in Fernandina, which I understand was around 2nd or 3rd Street.
Yep.
Do you remember?
So I remember very well. 2nd Street. The Christophers had the. They had what they call a Club 440.
Was that a nightclub?
It was a nightclub.
Okay.
Yeah. And across the street, one of the Christopher brothers had a barbershop there, and down the street was another black barbershop. Now, I understand dating back before I can remember, there might have been some more black businesses there.
Have you ever heard of Hippert?
Hippert's? Yeah, Hippert had the place. Our place was on 3rd Street, which was a beautiful bar.
It was a bar.
It was a bar.
It was a restaurant too.
Bar, restaurant, right behind the Allen store. They had like a roof that extended over the sidewalk. And I think when I was, I never went in there until I was 18 years old. I might have walked in. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, the gentleman, this guy, Lewis Williams, he was there at the time, and he told me, "Come on in." And I looked around, but I never was a drinker, even after, and so I had no reason to really go in there, other than socializing with people.
Mm-hmm.
The bar was a beautiful bar inside. Her husband, I think he came from the island somewhere, and he did all of the woodwork himself.
Okay.
And it's beautiful wood carving that was in the bar, and later on in life it burned.
Where would that, what's there now?
It's a parking lot now.
Parking lot.
Parking lot.
Isn't that a shame?
Yeah.
That's absolutely a shame.
Yeah. And when I was in school, even when the bar was there, well, my music teacher, he had a little, across the street, he had a little luncheonette. This is back in the 50s, and he and his wife mainly ran that for him.
Okay.
And next door to them, going back before the luncheonette was there, there was a cleaning shop. They called it a pressing club back then. I think it was Fred Haywood. I think it was Haywood's Pressing Club, I think.
Okay. Do you remember, you mentioned the name Allen, do you remember Allen's little restaurant, the tennis player?
Yes, the daughter was a tennis player, yes.
Okay, yes, yeah. And the mother and the daughter were around that restaurant a lot.
Yeah, but this even came after, this was later, way later,
okay.
This was in the 70s they had this.
Did that building, was that building a part of the old, was that?
That building there was a taxi stand.
I see.
Next door to her now was another black business, was a pool room and barber shop.
And
beer and wine,
okay.
And his name was the name was Davis. We called him Peg Davis. I can't think of his first name, but he had four sons, two still living, two are dead, and he had that building for long, right directly across from the old bus station.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, the building where Allen's restaurant, tennis player, was the bus station.
That was, that was a taxi stand.
Oh, I see. The bus station was across
the bus street. Station was across the street.
I see.
Yeah, the building still stands where the bus station was.
They talk about that area, was at one time a red light district?
I guess you could call it that, yeah. Back in the 50s, because there was so much, the fishing industry was so great, and the mills were great, and I can remember moonshine and stuff, and people sold it from different houses and things, and the fishermen would come into town, and they would you know, come with the season and leave with going other ways.
Yeah,
I guess you might call it a red light district.
Okay. We talked a little bit about the western part of the county, just very briefly, Callahan and Hilliard. Can you think of anything else that you might tell me about good black folks out in the country? Or
I didn't know that many people until, well, we had Bryan Academy, which is now Yulee Elementary School on the right-hand side.
Bryan,
B-R-Y-A-N-T. Bryan Academy. He was the black principal out there. They, they named it after him, and then he later on came to Peck, but they only went up until the eighth grade, I think it was. Eighth or ninth grade, and then the kids would be bused into Fernandina. Now that's how I got to meet a lot of the kids from out in the country, as we call the country.
Okay.
But other than that, I used to go out there and play baseball when I was 16, 17 years old, playing baseball in Callahan and Yulee. And
Neil, did they have the same kind of relationship with whites out there that you enjoyed here in Old Town?
I don't think so. No, because things out there were so spread apart. They live, you know, a house here, and there was no real concentrated area. There was a concentrated area of blacks in Yulee, right behind that trailer area. Now it's trailer park. There was still spread all over. Blacks owned a lot of land out there, and they were, you know, I mean, we're talking, I guess, 5 or 6 acres per family sometime areas, and so they were spread out. They were here in Old Town. We were all together.
Before I turn that off, is there anything else that you think is of historical interest that we haven't touched on that's run through your mind while we've been talking?
I've been trying to think as we go, but I really can't think of anything else right now that would be of...
All right, okay. Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed this. I'm going to turn it off now.